It certainly is good to stand before y'all once again. I've had this one thought on my mind this entire week, and it's stayed on my mind throughout this service, so I trust it's of the Lord. I ask that y'all pray for me as I stand up before y'all this morning. Have your Bibles turn to Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 9, read 9 through 11. O Zion, that bringest good tidings, get thee up into the high mountain. O Jerusalem, that bringest good tidings, lift up thy voice of strength. Lift it up, be not afraid. Say unto the cities of Judah, behold your God. Behold, the Lord God will come a strong hand, and his arm shall rule for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his work before him. He shall feed his flock like a shepherd. He shall gather the lambs with his arms, and carry them in his bosom. And shall gently lead those that are with young. O Zion, the church, behold your God. The Lord is so good to us. And oftentimes in this life, when we're going through trouble and tribulations, we don't go to the Lord as first, even though we should. And the Lord can still bless. But it's oftentimes we don't see it because we didn't go to him at first. There's a couple of examples in the scripture where the people that are in these hard situations went to the Lord and the Lord delivered them. Acts chapter 16, when Paul and Silas were in the jail cell and they started singing praises to thy name, and the earthquake came and all the prisoners in there escaped, and the guard came and was baptized, and Paul baptized the prison guard later that night. Daniel chapter 3, when the three Hebrew children were in the fire pit, and when Nebuchadnezzar saw them in there, he said, I saw, but there's four people in there, and the fourth person was the image of the Son of God. He is so good to us, and oftentimes we fail to see that because we try to rely on our own. We try to rely on what we can do. And oftentimes the Lord will still bless us, but again, we don't see it. An example of that would be when the Lord told Aaron to speak into the rock, but he smote the rock. And the Lord said, because of this, y'all cannot enter Canaan's land. May we never forget to put our faith in the Lord, for he is good to us, and he deserves all of our praise. And when he gives, and when we see what he does, may we go out there and thank him for what he's done. Thank you for y'all's attention.
Very much appreciate that which has gone before. And one of the things that was brought before us that I think is very crucial when it comes to Zion and the house of God. A lot of things that set the Lord's church apart from other institutions and various enterprises in this world is most institutions and enterprises want you to look at them. For example, if you want a job, you want people to look at you. You write a resume, you put all these awards and various things that you've done. When it comes to other ventures, you know, when you go to somebody's house, what do they want you to see? They want you to see pictures of them because that's what they have on. You're not going to find a picture of yourself unless you're part of that family. You're going to find pictures of them on the wall. And there's, I'm not saying these things are wrong. It's just how the world operates. It's how natural things progress. But when it comes to the house of God, we have not come here to look at ourselves or to cause others to look at ourselves. We are here for one thing and one thing only, to say, there he is. There's what he has done. There's where he sits. There's where he reigns. Whenever John the Baptist came on the scene, and of course a lot of that language in Isaiah 40 is prophetic of John the Baptist coming. And when he came, there were a lot of people who wondered things about him. They said, well, is he this one? Is he this one? Is he this one? And he kept saying, no, I'm not him, him, or him. And they said, well, who are you? He said, I'm the voice of him crying in the wilderness. And what was the voice crying in the wilderness to say? Behold your God. And when Jesus came to him, what did he say? He says, behold, the Lamb of God, which taketh away the sin of the world. And from that very moment that Jesus appeared on the banks of the Jordan River, what does John say about him? He said, He must increase, but I must decrease. And what I say as I go through life in this world, as I try to point him out to God's people, is to say this: the older I get, the more I decrease. But the older I get, I thank God, the more he increases. Not that he's literally getting bigger, but that I see him bigger and better than I ever have. What did Mary say when the angel came to her? She said, "My soul doth magnify the Lord." A magnification doesn't make anything truly bigger, but it makes it look bigger. And friends, as we get older, he can increase and look bigger as we tell people, "Behold him." And you can spend your life looking at him and considering him. And you'll never get to how big he is or how wonderful he is. But one of the things that we strive for in the house of God is to pull the curtain back just a little more, just a little more, to say there's more of him and there's more of him, and to see more of him as we go forward. And there in Isaiah 40, this is something, as Brother Silas read to us, that is not just for those who have a very full and deep natural understanding. Because this is a shepherd who is not just caring for the old rams, he's caring also for the little ones of the flock as well. You know, one of the precious things to me about beholding God in this fashion, in an assembly like we're in, there are things that we know that we can't explain. There's things that we understand that we can't describe. And these things do not require a full set of natural skills and knowledge to understand it. I can remember as a little boy, even before I joined the church, that there were moments in the house of God when I would feel things and I would be uplifted and carried away. I couldn't tell you why it was. I couldn't tell you exactly all the things the preacher was preaching about. But friends, when somebody comes into the kingdom, and when somebody is laboring in the vineyard, whether they've been there all day or whether they've been there 1 hour, what is the Lord able to do? Raise them all up together to see the same thing, to experience the same thing. Because at the end of the day, when we all get our penny, we can all say it's been good to have been in the house of the Lord this day. And when it comes to the little ones here, there are things that they may not understand. There are things they may not be able to describe. But don't for a minute think that just because they don't understand it and they can't describe it, that they can't behold the God of Zion. Because friends, when he comes into an assembly, and when he appears and makes himself manifest, when the Holy Ghost comes down from heaven, friends, there are things that we can behold that it's not a question of how much this mind understands. It's not a question of how much this body has experienced. It's a question, friends, of a soul that is reaching out, and that God by his Spirit is reaching down, and hand joins in hand and heart is knit to heart, and we feel him and we walk with him and we observe him for a little while. Now let's back up in Isaiah chapter 40 and let's grab a couple of verses before where Brother Silas was, to behold God in a way in which I think is still of value to God's people today. In Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 1, the prophet writes, comfort ye, my people, saith your God. Speak ye comfortably unto Jerusalem, and cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she hath received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. Now, if you spend any time in the church, you've heard this quoted, you've heard this preached, you've heard this referenced, and I hope in your studies you've read it and you've been comforted thereby. And in so reading it and considering it, let us consider it, friends, for what this did for them on that day to behold their God. Because I realize the beholding God is in verse 9, but I believe everything leading up to that is showing how they had been beholding him in recent days. As the book of Isaiah transitions, because 39 to 40 is a transition, there's still some things that Isaiah 40 is reaching back and drawing from. It says that there were three things that were supposed to give them comfort on that day. One, that their warfare was accomplished. Two, that their iniquity was pardoned. And three, that they'd received of the Lord's hand double for all their sins. Now, what had they just experienced? What had they just been through? What had the kingdom of Judah just recently experienced in the last few days, weeks, months, and maybe even a year or so? If you go back and you look at chapter 36, 37, 38, and 39, you'll find three things that they had recently gone through, that those three things kind of tie into what Isaiah is writing about. And that those three things were to get them to look at something particular. And it wasn't themselves, it was at what God had done for them. In Isaiah 36 and 37, this is also found in the book of Kings and Chronicles, there is a situation that besieges Judah. Sennacherib's army, the Assyrian kingdom, has come and surrounded Jerusalem. And he's got a really bold and brash mouthpiece named Rabshakeh, who stands there and he starts crying unto them on the wall. And he basically tells them, you need to basically just give up. You need to surrender. You need to just, if you would, just send some men out to be part of our army and we'll leave you alone. And who are you going to call? Are you going to call Egypt? Egypt's so weak compared to Assyria that if a man lean on it like leaning on a staff, it's going to go right through his hand. Who are you going to lean on? God? Well, Hezekiah, your king's already cut down all your high places. Who are you going to serve? Who you got? Who can stand up? I mean, look at us. Look how big we are. And friends, naturally speaking, compared to what they were in the city, they were no match for Sennacherib's army. They were no match for this situation. And Rabshakeh probably looked around and said, we got this one in the bag. I can say whatever I want. Nothing can happen. And Hezekiah receives a letter, and he unrolls it in the house of God, and he falls down and he prays to God, and he says this. He said, O Lord, consider their words. Consider that they're vain words. And hear us and hear our prayer and our supplication from heaven. And the Lord does hear and the Lord does deliver because he sends one angel that night and one angel wipes out 185,000 men. Now, I don't know if that's the extent of an angel's ability in one night. I have no idea. I know at least one angel wiped out 70,000 men over 3 days whenever David sinned. So I don't know what the extent of what they can do is. But I know at least in this case, one angel can kill 185,000 men in one night. Now, this isn't part of the sermon, but when Jesus tells Peter, put his sword up again into its place, for I can now ask of my Father and call more than 12 legions of angels. I don't care if you think a legion 6,000, 9,000, 12,000, or 24,000. I've heard all of those numbers displayed. Can we just say that more than 12 legions of angels, however many thousand that is, it's a lot of angels. And if that's a lot of angels, and one angel can wipe out 185,000 men in one night, how many people do you think could have been wiped out the night Jesus was taken if he'd have so chosen? He could have wiped out the entire world. And friends, he can still wipe out the entire world. And I thank God that even now while we can't see them, much like it was with Elisha and his servant, when they were surrounded and he says, Master, what are we going to do? He says, Lord, open his eyes that he may see. And when he opened his eyes, he saw the mountains around them covered with fire and chariots and angels and a heavenly host. And that's the way it is today, friends. No matter how surrounded you are in your life, there are still angels round about. There's still fire round about. There's still a heavenly host round about. And the Lord has things well in hand because if he so chooses, he can wipe them out just like that. And what happened the very next morning is when they looked up from the wall, I mean, all those things that distressed them, they were all gone. All the things that had been plaguing them, they were all gone. I mean, here's this army having to go back to its homeland in shame, and the strongest king of that day, when he got home, he was worshiping in the house of his God, and his own sons rose up and killed him. I mean, that's how quickly it all went down. And what does he say to give Jerusalem comfort? He says, cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished. What that scene did is it reminded Judah and Jerusalem that there are things that you can't handle, there's things that you can't get past, but don't worry about it because when it's something you can't handle, I can. When it's something you can't do, I can. What does Paul say in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13? He says that no temptation hath taken you, but such is common to man, but God is faithful. And he won't what? He won't suffer you to be tempted above that which you're able, but will with the temptation make a way to escape that you may be able to bear it. Here we find a situation that they could not deal with. So what did God do? He dealt with it. Friends, there's things in our life that we can't handle. So what happens? He handles them for us. And the things that we can handle, he mercifully handles them with us and walks with us when he gives us a way to escape. And one of the greatest ways, friends, in which we couldn't handle something is we couldn't handle our warfare when it comes to heaven, immortal glory, and eternal matters. And that's why the captain of our salvation came down and he was made perfect through suffering. And as such, friends, our warfare is accomplished because all the battles that we fight on a day-to-day basis, all the struggles that we go through, doesn't change the fact that our captain has won the war forever and evermore. He hath by one offering perfected, how long? Forever, them that are sanctified. And friends, the greatest comfort that a child of God can have today is knowing that because that war is finished, the warfare that I go through now, it does not change the outcome of how the war is going to be.
And one of the greatest things that I can lay my head down at night and rest about is that with my faults and with my failures and with my struggles, this little private's woes in the army doesn't change the fact that my captain still won the war. You know, we're coming into a time of year where certain dates and certain remembrances are starting to be made. I mean, there's just a few weeks and there's going to be an observance and a remembrance made of the independence of this country. Friends, there were people who did not observe the independence of this country because they did not recognize this country as really being a country on the day they signed the Declaration of Independence. You know what happened? A war was fought to establish whether this was a country or not. And friends, there are people who do not recognize what God, the God of this Bible, of this church, and of this universe is and what he has done. And he fought a war to settle all that. And friends, that war has been settled. I don't understand a lot about the book of Revelation, but may I encourage you with this? When you're reading the book of Revelation, don't get all too concerned about who this monster is and who that monster is and who this creature is and who that creature is. I mean, if you come and ask me, who are all these monsters and who are all these creatures, I'm probably going to say, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know, and I don't know. But here's what I do know. If you focus on the monsters of Revelation, it's going to be the same thing as focusing on the monsters of our own life. They're going to garner our attention and our affection and our thoughts far too much. The thing to consider when reading the book of Revelation, like reading the entire Bible, is not the monsters. It's the one who beat all the monsters. It's the one who won all the wars. It's the one who was not just barely victorious in battle. He squashed them all, and it wasn't even a contest. You know, there are times when, you know, you watch a sporting event, and you're like, man, I just want to see a good game. I don't really care about this team. I don't really care about that team. So just give me a good game. But if it's your team playing, be honest. Do you want a good game? Do you want a nail biter? Do you want to have a heart attack? No, you want to blow them out. Well, friends, the captain of our salvation, he blew them out. If you'll allow me to say this, it was infinity on his end of the scoreboard and a big fat zero on theirs. And when you consider what he is and who he is and what he's done, our warfare has been accomplished not only in Jesus Christ, but it's accomplished now because all the things that we face now do not change that one bit. And friends, all the things that plagued them, they were all taken away. And the things that plague us are taken away both now through his grace and eventually one day in glorification by his power. And the next thing that is mentioned is it says that their iniquities are pardoned. And this is a very interesting phrase to consider us to look at God and to consider him. But consider what the word pardon means. The word pardon means a forbearing of consequence. For example, if you were convicted of a crime and you were actually guilty of that crime and condemned by a court of law for that crime, and let's say the governor, the president, or whoever gives you a pardon for that crime, you're still guilty. You still stand as a ex-con, ex-felon, whatever the case may be, but you have all those consequences forborne. There was a country music singer many years ago, won't mention his name, but his initials are Merle Haggard, who received a pardon because he was guilty of grand theft auto or larceny or something, and he received a gubernatorial pardon from the state of California, and he was released out of prison and had a whole career. Well, friends, he was still guilty of the crime, and he still was listed as an ex-felon, but all the consequences that he had to face were all put away. And friends, when it tells Judah that her comfort is that her consequences have been put away, consider what happens in Isaiah 38. In Isaiah 38, Hezekiah is sick unto death. He has been told by the prophet, basically set your house and affairs in order, you're going to die. And so he immediately does what he did back in chapter 37. He turns his face to the wall and he prays to the Lord and begs of him to deliver him, begs of him to spare his life. And before Isaiah even gets out of the palace, the Lord turns the prophet back around and basically says this, I've heard your prayers, I've seen your tears, and I'm going to add unto thy days 15 years. And he says, and he basically causes the sun, the shadow on the sundial to go down 10 degrees or backwards 10 degrees as a token of God's promise. And he had 15 years added to his life. Now, let me ask you this. if Hezekiah had not prayed, what would have happened? I know what would have happened. The Lord said what would have happened. He would have died. If this does not prove, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that we do not have an appointed time to die, I don't know what else does. And I'll throw this out, no extra charge. If somebody believes that you have an appointed time to die, ask them why they ever pray for anybody's sickness, why they ever pray for anybody's deliverance. Either it's their time or it's not. Furthermore, if it's somebody's time to die, how do you ever prosecute a murderer or somebody who put somebody to death? It was just their time to go. But friends, what this proves is this. Our days can be shortened and our days can be lengthened. Our days are not set from the moment we come into this world. There are choices that we make that can cut those things short. David writes in the book of Psalms that bloody and deceitful men will not live out half their days. In other words, they could have lived longer, but their lifestyle caused their life to end sooner. There are other people, friends, that have been given extremely long life and good quality of life based on God's mercy. Brother Silas mentioned Moses smiting the rock, and because of that, he didn't go into Canaan's land. Let me ask you this question. I realize he was 120 years old when he died, but do you think he could have gone into Canaan's land? I do. Bible says his eyesight was not dim and his natural force wasn't abated. That means that he still had good strength, he had good quality, he could still see. What'd that be like at 120 years old? Still picking stuff up and saying, oh, I see a deer out there. I mean, I'm not 120, far from it, and my eyesight's failing, my strength is failing, but here's Moses. Still got good strength, still got good eyesight. Why did his life end? Judgment. His days were cut short. And friends, here's Hezekiah, who's one of the most righteous kings that Judah and Jerusalem ever had, who's done what his fathers didn't do, who's the very first king to be measured up to his father David. Because all the good kings that came before him, it says they did that which was right, but not like their father David. They did that which was right, but not like their father David. You know, Abijam was that way, Asa was that way, Amaziah was that way, Uzziah was that way. They were all righteous, but not like their father David. But when Hezekiah comes on the scene, it says that he was righteous in the sight of God, and he did that which was right, as did his father David. He cut down all the high places. He cut down all the groves. In other words, here's a man who did the very best that he could to get his kingdom cleaned up, shored up, squared and ordered, so that it would appear before God as a beautiful emblem and as a good offering in his sight. And now here's that same man coming to the Lord and saying, please, Lord, don't take my life. And the Lord adds unto his life. His consequences were taken away. And I want you to consider what happens when the Lord takes his consequences away. Is Hezekiah still a sinner? Yes, he is. Is Hezekiah still going to mess up? Yes, he is. Hang with us. We'll get to that. Is Hezekiah still going to make wrong decisions? Yes, he is. And the Lord, in his mercy, has extended this man's life knowing that he's still a sinner, knowing that he's still going to mess up, and he does that knowing full well what Hezekiah is going to be, because, friends, this is the God that we serve. This is the God that we consider. This is the God we have come to behold, that he knows all about us. I mean, if we all knew all about each other, down to the very thoughts and intents of our heart, we might not want to be in the building with each other. I mean, I'm just saying. I don't know what's going on in your mind and heart, but if you knew everything that was happening up here, and you knew everything that was happening in here, you'd be like, can we have a pastor call right now and uncall him? maybe he doesn't even need to be a member here. Because that's, I mean, we have things that go through our head that we're like, man, I wish I didn't think about things like that. We have things that go through our heart. We think, man, I wish I didn't think about things like that. He knows all those things. But more than that, friends, he knows them before they even happened. He knows them before they come to pass. And all that you're going to do this week, and all that you're going to do even later today, he knows all that. And as bad as it could be, as bad as it might be, he forbears the consequences for those things to bless us right now in his house. Is that not worth beholding? Is that not worth considering, friends? That he who knows what we are and what we will be and what we will do still blesses us now, knowing that he is forbearing consequences. He's pardoning iniquity so that we could walk with him, have fellowship with him, and walk hand in hand with him all the days of our life. Friends, that is worth thinking about and considering every day that we wake up, that when we have the opportunity to walk hand in hand with Jesus, he is doing so knowing full well not what we could be, but what we are. Not knowing what we might be, but what we will be. And knowing that, friends, he still willingly joins his hand with us. And in so doing, friends, shows mercy that I can't even begin to describe, that he would have such tokens of grace upon a people as we are. Because I think back through the years of all the things that I have done and all the steps and the wayward ways that I've taken. And friends, he never left me. Not only did he never leave me, there were times, friends, that I didn't know it at the time, but he scooped me up and carried me in ways I knew not, in places that I didn't think I'd ever been. I look back and I see the hand of God as he has walked with me and taken care of me. There's an old picture. I don't know if it's hanging in any of your houses, but it used to hang in a lot of Primitive Baptist houses. And it was a picture of footprints in the sand. And as you look, the description says that at times there were two sets of footprints walking through the sand. But at the hardest moments and at the hardest times of life, there was only one set of footprints. And when I look back, I asked God, I said, I could see where you walked with me. I could see where we walked together. But why at the hardest moments of my life, why in my darkest times, did you leave me to walk alone? And the Lord answers, my child, it was during those times it was only my footprint because I picked you up and I carried you through that season. Friends, there are things that we have brought upon ourselves that he still picks us up and carries us through that season. I thank God that he's not just merciful to us when life invades. I'm thankful he's not just merciful to us when other people mess up our life. I thank God he's merciful to me even when I mess up my life. Even when the steps that I'm taking and the places that I am are things that I've chosen to do, he still comes and he picks me up and he carries me. And here's Hezekiah, who I don't know if this sickness was something genetic. I don't know if it was something that was based on his lifestyle. I have no idea. But the Lord in his mercy still came in and forbore some consequences for Hezekiah to carry on. And consider this, if you will, that Hezekiah reigned for 29 years. Over Judah and Jerusalem. If he hadn't had 15 years, he'd only reigned for 14. The Lord gave him more than double his kingdom reign by this mercy, by this act, by pardoning his iniquity, which leads us into the very next saying when he says that she hath received of the Lord's hand double for all her iniquities. Consider what happens in the very next chapter, chapter 39. Here's Hezekiah. He's been sick. He's been about to die, and now the Lord's given him recovery. He knows he's got 15 years in front of him. And a king from a neighboring region hears about this, and he says, you know, Hezekiah is a good man. Let me send some people to him to tell him I'm encouraged, that I'm comforted that he's still alive, that he hasn't died. So the king of Babylon sends ambassadors to Jerusalem because he heard that Hezekiah was sick, and he wanted to establish some good communication, because he was glad that this man was still alive. And when Hezekiah sees him, what does he do? He says, well, let me show you everything. Friends, he took those ambassadors to places that they had no right to be. He took them to see things they had no right to even set foot in. The Bible says that when it came to the Lord's tabernacle, the Lord's temple, when it comes to the assembly, where the congregation assembled, that there were certain people that had no right to be in that assembly. There were certain people that couldn't be in there for so many generations, but some couldn't be in there, period. It was not a place for just showing people. Now, if he'd invite them into his home, that would be one thing. But he can't invite them into the house of God when the house of God says there's a prohibition on people like that. And friends, when it comes to the house of God today, we don't have a prohibition of people even coming through the door. But we do have prohibitions of people coming into the house of God. And what are those prohibitions? The things that God has established that his church would be ordered up in a certain way. He says in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, not to have fellowship with drunkards and fornicators and adulterers and people that are living a life of reproach and shame in this world. Now that's not popular in the world we live in today, but friends, how serious does God take his house? How serious does God take people in his house? Here's how serious he takes it. When those ambassadors have left, Isaiah comes back to Hezekiah and he says, who came in here? He said, some ambassadors from the land of Babylon. What did they see? Everything. And what does Isaiah tell him? Thou hast done foolishly. You've been lifted up in your own heart and you've done foolishly. And because of that, The very same people that came to see you are going to be the very same people that bring this land to ruin. And it was Babylon who took Judah captive, who razed Jerusalem to the ground. And he says, these are the very same people that are going to take all this splendor that you see, and they're going to make a ruin of it. But notice what he says. At the very end of Isaiah 39, he says, but because of the goodness of thine heart, it shall not be in thy day, but it shall come in thy son's day. Now this seems so unfair. Here's a son who hadn't even been born, and it's going to come in his day for something Hezekiah did. If you don't hear anything else, children especially, listen to this. There are things that you are going to be a beneficiary or a victim of many times in life because of what someone or somebody else did. That's just a reality of life. There are things in my life that I'm a beneficiary of that I had nothing to do with because of the actions of others. My parents were good parents. I didn't ask to be born in their family. I didn't ask to be born into their home, but I had good parents. I didn't ask to be born in America, but I was. I didn't ask to be born in Texas, but I was. So I was born to the greatest parents in the greatest state of the greatest country in the world. I didn't ask for that, but that's what I had. What am I? I'm the beneficiary of things that I had nothing to do with. On the other hand, there are people who can come in to situations that they had nothing to do with, and the consequences for those situations are upon them. Friends, I did come into this world as a member of the race of Adam. What does that mean? There are consequences upon the race of Adam that I came into. It didn't have anything to do with it, but I came into those consequences. But thank God, I also came into the family of God, not by anything I have done, but because of that, I am a beneficiary of the work of Christ and the representation of Christ to me. We can spend all day arguing, complaining about what's fair and what's right, but I love something that Elder Bill Walden told me years ago. I asked him a question that I thought was a really, really good question. Turns out it was really dumb. And he didn't tell me it was dumb, but looking back, I can see him just sitting there on the phone just thinking, oh my goodness, this poor guy. So I called him and I said, Brother Bill, I've got a question. And he goes, what is it? And I said, if Adam and Eve had had children before they ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, how would that have worked? Because those children weren't in them anymore. They weren't in their loins. Would they have had to eat in two to fall? And he kind of chuckled. He said, Brother Philip, you can spend your life wondering what if and what could have been. He said, the fact of the matter is, no man knows what if and what could have been. Spend your time focusing on what is and what will be. That's good advice, friends. Don't spend your time focusing on what if and what could be. Focus your time spending it on what is and what will be. Because I can tell you this, we can spend all of our time talking about what's fair and what's not. It still is. It's still reality. It's still the world we live in. And so here's Hezekiah being told, here's judgment coming because of what you've done. You're not going to have it in your day. It's going to come in your son's day. And what does Hezekiah say? Notice the very end of Isaiah 39. He says, good is the word which the Lord has spoken. I'm not going to argue with this. It's good which the Lord has spoken. He said, for there shall be peace and truth in my day. Hezekiah understood that even though he'd come short, even though he had messed up, even though the Lord had already blessed him to have his iniquities pardoned, even though the Lord had already blessed him to have his warfare accomplished, the Lord still gave him more than he deserved because he was going to have peace and truth in his day. I ask you this question, friends. Think about our life in which we live. Think about what we can consider and what we can observe. Our warfare has been accomplished in Jesus Christ. It's been put away forever and evermore. He has foreborne so many consequences, not just eternally, but also here in time, in my life. And yet I still mess up. I still come short of the glory of God. I still continue to go astray. Do you think the Lord in Isaiah 38 knew that Isaiah 39 was going to happen? Sure he did. He knew by extending Hezekiah's life, this event was going to take place. He knew Hezekiah was going to mess up. He still had mercy on him anyway. Friends, he knows that I'm going to mess up, and he still has mercy on me anyway. But even in the midst of my mess ups, he still doesn't punish me like I deserve. What does it say in Ezra chapter 9 and verse 13 or 14? The children of Israel have just come back from Babylon and from Median Persian captivity. They're trying to raise Jerusalem back up, raise the walls back up, and build a temple again. And while they're doing all this, they start joining affinity to different nations. They start taking wives and husbands of other people of other lands, people they have no business marrying. And when Ezra and Nehemiah hear about this, they become so distressed about it. Of, we just got back home. We're just now starting to do all this. We need to ask the Lord to please help us. So they go and they talk to the Lord. And this is what they say. They say, seeing that we have received good of thy hand, and that thou hast punished us less than our iniquities deserve, why should we join in affinity and abomination to the people of this world? Friends, I ask you that question today. When you consider that he has punished us less than our iniquities deserve, that he's good to us in ways that I can't even begin to count up, why should I join affinity to the things of this world? But even when we have, even when we do, you know, the Lord still blessed the Jerusalem to be raised. He still blessed the temple to be built. He still blessed them to inhabit that land again. In the midst of my sufferings and in the midst of my faults and my wrongdoings, he still blesses me to inhabit Jerusalem. He still blesses me to inhabit his temple. He still blesses me to have peace and truth in my day. Friends, it's not just that I've received the Lord's hand double for all my iniquities when it comes to heaven and immortal glory, because I deserved hell, and he brought me up out of hell, and he'll one day bring me up out all the way into heaven. That's receiving of his hand double for all my iniquities, that were sin abounded, grace did much more abound. I'm gone from eternal death to eternal life. But friends, it's more than that. He turns and renders unto us double today, because it's not just that we have the truth. He's blessed us with peace in having the truth. It's not just in having peace, but it's having the truth that goes along with that peace. I mentioned yesterday that whenever a church can answer in peace, the only way that she can do that is when the Prince of Peace abides in the house. And friends, when we have peace in an unpeaceful world, that's receiving of the Lord's hand something that is alien and foreign to this world. The world has not been at peace ever since the fall in the garden, and it's not going to be in peace until the Lord folds it up and burns it up at the last day. If you're looking for peace, it's not going to happen. I think I've told this story, but I'll tell it again. It's worth telling. I was at a convention down in Orlando many years ago. I was a very young preacher at the time, and there was a lady at our table who was basically the captain of our table. She was running the conversation. She was holding court. Her name was Harriet from New Jersey. And I will always remember this woman. She had a very distinctive voice. And all they could talk about at this table, well, at least it's all Harriet wanted to talk about, was George W. Bush's new peace plan for the Middle East. And, of course, she had all these issues with it. It's not going to work because of this, 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 and this. Of course, I agreed with her. It wasn't. But then she said, but this will work. And she lined out her peace plan. And I'll just say this. It didn't strike me as being any more intelligent than George W. Bush's. I couldn't see anything that was like, oh, that sounds like a great idea. But, of course, I knew better. And, of course, they're talking about it back and forth. I'm eating my soup, trying to mind my own business. And unfortunately, at those places, you're all wearing name tags. You know, all God's children say, hello, my name is Philip. So she looks down the table and she goes, Philip, you haven't said anything. And I said, no, I haven't. And she goes, well, don't you have an opinion? I said, I do. And she goes, would you like to share? I said, do you want to hear? She goes, yes. And I said, okay, there will never be peace over there. Never has been, never will be. She looked like I was a creature from Mars. And I said, all those people over there come from a man by the name of Ishmael, who was Abraham's son. And what was said of him was that he would be a wild man. His hand would be raised against every man, and every man's hand raised against him. And it's been that way since that very time. And if they don't have anybody else to fight, they'll fight each other. And they've been doing that, and will keep doing that. There's not going to be peace. She called me a racist, a misogynist, a chauvinist, a bunch of other ists that I can't even remember what they all are. And I looked at her and I said, that's fine. And she, I guess, had never heard anybody call all those things and smiled at her. And I said, if I am, God is, and that's pretty good company. So I moved on. She didn't, but I did. But my point is this. You can argue and fight about it, but that's just the way it is. And I don't care who your guy is in the White House, he's not going to bring peace over there, because the Lord said it's not going to happen. And may I also say this, not just about the Middle East, but about this world in general. You will never find utopia in this world, because this world is corrupted with sin. And because it's corrupted with sin, it's going to have chaos and heartbreak and sorrow and distress until it ends. But I tell you, there's a place in this world that is brought out of this world. that you can have peace. A place that has its conversation in heaven. A place that has its roots in the very throne room of God. A place where God comes and tabernacles and dwells with men. And friends, here it is that you can find peace on earth. You're not going to find it in all the affairs and cares of this world, but you can find peace in a place in this world that is not of this world. In a people that are walking in this world but don't belong to this world. As fellow pilgrims and strangers dwelling in tabernacles of clay, we can come together with God in our midst, and He brings us peace. He brings us that very feeling that it's going to be all right. Because friends, I've come to the house of God and I've been torn up. I've had my heart just torn in several different pieces. I've had chaos going on in my mind. And He comes through that storm and once again tells me, it's going to be all right. What am I doing, friends? I'm beholding the very throne room of God where He sits. I'm beholding Him who sits upon the throne. As Isaiah said earlier in his letter, he says, when he sees the Lord high and lifted up, when he sees His train filling the temple, when he hears the heavenly host singing, "Holy, holy, holy," he says, "Oh, woe is me, for I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips." But what does the Lord do? He takes the coal off the fire of the altar in God in heaven, and He touches it to His tongue and says, "You've been cleansed. You're a sinner. Yes, you dwell in the midst of a sinful people. But because of this experience, you've been cleansed, and you feel like you can go to the point that when the Lord said, 'Whom shall I send? Who shall go for us?' Here's Isaiah saying, 'Here am I, send me.'" A few moments before, he says, "I'm an unclean man." Now he's raising his hand saying, "Lord, I'm here, send me." Friends, that's what the house of God does. That's what the Lord's blessings to us does. We come in and we feel woeful. We come in and we feel sinful. But we leave and we feel cleansed. We leave and we feel charged up. We've seen God. We've walked with God. We've walked in fertile fields with Him. And we feel like for a little while, if you send, Lord, I'll go. If you say do it, I'll do it. If you say refrain, I won't. But if you bless the sound of the going to be in the tops of mulberry trees, I'll be up and ready for the fight. And I tell you what, friends, that kind of peace cannot be found anywhere else in this old world. You won't find it in natural family. You won't find it in a job. You won't find it in any of the recreation or hobbies of this world. You will only find it in the house of God, in the kingdom of His dear Son. Because, friends, here it is that the General Assembly and the Church of the Firstborn joins in concert with the great congregation. And here it is, friends, that you and I have met together with not just an innumerable company of angels, not just with Him, but also with the spirits of just men made perfect and the blood of sprinkling that crieth better things than that of Abel. Because, friends, the truth that gives so much peace is the truth of this, that even though we deserved hell, even though we deserved the justice of Almighty God that never has an end, that will go on, Lord, without end, for the devil, his angels, and all the non-elect, we have the blood of sprinkling at our altar that cries out for mercy. It cries out for grace. It cries out, friends, that pleads for Jesus' sake. When we behold God in this place, everything we do is a plea for Jesus' sake. Whether it's the songs that we sing, the prayers that we offer, or the preaching that goes forth, it's all done in the name of Jesus. It's done for Jesus' sake. And what does He promise us? Anything you ask in my name, the Father's going to grant it. And friends, what has the Father granted unto us? But He's granted unto us peace and truth in our days. I know that my children, long after I'm gone, are going to labor with the handicaps that I've given them. The handicaps that I've given them genetically, the handicaps that I've given them as being brought up in my home, and just the handicap in general of being my child. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. You can't escape sometimes where you came from. People are going to see it. I mean, we never got past the fact that every time we came to a church meeting in Texas, as soon as we walked up on the ground, people would see my dad and say, "Hey, Governor, how you doing?" He was shot with Kennedy in 1963, and they still made a joke about him being the governor in the 90s. He never got past that. Now, I'm not saying that was wrong. I'm just saying there are things you don't ever live past. I mean, they stay with you all the days of your life. But I thank God that He hasn't just given me double from hell into heaven, but He's turned again and given double to His people now. That we don't just have peace without truth. We don't just have truth without peace. But that we have peace and truth that have met together. And they've met together because righteousness and peace kissed each other in the person of Jesus Christ. Because when that moment happened, truth had sprung out of the earth. and righteousness had looked down from heaven. And because of that, friends, we have a situation here that we can come and we can behold Him. And we don't behold Him fearfully like, oh my goodness, what a horrible sight. We can come with peace and knowing that He's our advocate, He's our brother, He's our husband, He's our best friend. He's the one that cares for us. And we can hear once again of the truth that no matter what happens in this old world, no matter how many shortcomings we have, all the things that should have happened in our day, they happened to somebody else. Now let me just say this. Hezekiah wasn't exactly his son. It was his great-grandson, great-great-grandson, who experienced this, and he wasn't a good person. What he experienced because of Hezekiah's sin, he brought enough upon himself. I don't think anybody would call God unfair. But friends, what should have happened in our day and didn't, it happened 2,000 years ago in his day. And he stood where I should have stood for all the sins that I have committed. And what he went through in his day brought forth life and life more abundantly. What he did brought forth not just redemption, but a home here on this earth until we go home to be with him in heaven. What he did broke down a middle wall of partition so we can all come together in one body and one people. What he did is he brought us nigh unto him. And what he did most of all, in so doing, is he said, no matter what happens, no matter what happens, not just in death, but in life, no matter what happens, you're mine. You belong to me. I'm going to have you always. A lot of times we focus on him having us in heaven. Friends, he has us always. He holds us always. And it's not just that one day we're going to get to see him and walk with him in heaven. We get to see him and walk with him right now. What is the design needs to be comforted by? This. Behold your God. Behold what he's done. Behold what he's done, what he's doing, and what he's promised he will one day do. Friends, that's comfort that Jerusalem still needs. That is joy that Zion still needs to cry out with. And friends, with every opportunity that we have, may we come and behold our God who has been so very good to us. May the Lord bless you, is my prayer. We're going to stand together and sing a song in conclusion. Tell us to open the door of the church. There's one more here that would like to join the church. Just come, we'll sing. And on the second verse,